Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. A protest on the campus of Jawaharlal Nehru University has sparked a fierce debate in India over freedom of expression. The protest erupted after a student was arrested and accused of sedition for reportedly shouting anti-India slogans at a rally. And this is now getting attention in the U.S. media. The New York Times is reporting that there are many protests on the campus by leftist students, and they usually end without anyone paying attention. But this protest is receiving headlines because a TV crew taped it. And here in the United States, with the election in full swing, where are you going for coverage of the candidates' actual issues? Over the past couple of weeks, several economists have slammed and praised Bernie Sanders' economic plans, but why aren't the rest of the candidates receiving the same amount of scrutiny, especially Donald Trump? He could be the Republican nominee. So what is his platform exactly, and what explains this? I just got a news alert from CNN saying that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has endorsed Donald Trump's presidential bid at a press conference in Texas, saying there's no one better prepared to lead the country in the Republican race. And joining me to talk about media coverage of these issues are two guests. Sandeep Roy is a journalist based in Kolkata. He's the former Monday host of Your Call. Sandeep's debut novel is called Don't Let Him Know. Sandeep's dispatch from Kolkata can be heard on Wednesdays here on KALW at 7:35 a.m. and 4:45 p.m. Hi, Sandeep. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good to be back.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Zach Carter, a senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post, and he joins me from Washington. Hi, Zach. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have both of you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So Zach Carter, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I think there is a terrific piece by Alex Seitzwald and Benji Sarlin for the MSNBC.com website that just went up today, which is about Democrats being afraid of Donald Trump's potential viability in a general election. And I think it's a very good piece because while most political think pieces have just assumed that Donald Trump is totally unelectable, I think they really grasp the reasons why he has surprised the Republican establishment and why he could surprise the Democratic establishment as well, which particularly Democratic establishment, which does not seem to have been particularly interested in learning the lessons from Bernie Sanders, I think, surprising level of success in the Democratic primary.
Wow, that sounds interesting. We'll definitely talk about that later in the show. So kudos to MSNBC's Benji, was it Garland or Sarland?
Benji Sarlin and Alex Seitzwald.
Okay, great. Thank you for that one. And what about you, Sandeep? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, before I tell you my pick for this week, Rose, I'd like to mention that over in India, about a year, 2 years ago, we also thought Narendra Modi, the prime minister, was unelectable because of his record, because he was too extreme for the country. And now we are in the second year of the Modi premiership. So you have to always watch. You know, and a lot of people actually have drawn comparisons between Trump and Modi in certain ways. But in terms of the piece that has caught my attention this week is a story in my local Kolkata newspaper called The Telegraph. And it is a piece about another sedition story but happening in neighboring Bangladesh, which I think will be getting more attention in the West soon because the current government in Bangladesh is regarded as fairly a moderate government, friendly to the West. But it has been cracking down on media in that country over the last few years. And in this month, it has served, or people acting on its behalf, have served sedition notices to the largest English language newspaper in the country, which also owns the largest Bengali language newspaper in the country. And the story by Devdeep Purohit in Telegraph outlines sort of what's going on behind the scenes there, and we find out that the main problem is that the editor of the largest daily went on a television show and said that during a caretaker sort of military-backed government, he was wrong to have published some reports from the military intelligence without verifying it on his own, which, you know, some of these reports were linked to Sheikh Hasina, who is currently the prime minister in Bangladesh. And she says she went to prison as a result of that. All the media at that time had published the same report. This editor, Mahfooz Anam, was the only one who was courageous enough to do a mea culpa and say, I was wrong to have published that report. And as a price, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. So as a price for that, the government and ministers and Sheikh Hasina's relatives have said Mahfooz Anam should be charged with sedition and that he should resign. And they're going after the media in a huge way. Wow. I think this story is going to get more legs. The committee, the CPJ, has already highlighted this case.
Sandeep, what does it mean to charge a journalist with sedition in India?
We are learning this here right now. It basically is a giant sledgehammer which a government possesses, with which it can swat a fly. And it means very little in the sense of it takes very little, apparently, to charge someone with sedition. You can be shouting some slogan. You can be a hot-headed university student shouting slogans. And if the government decides those slogans are anti-India, it can charge you with sedition. Sedition here is actually a colonial-era law. Mm. It has been kept. It was used, ironically, mostly to charge people now Indians consider as freedom fighters, the ones who brought India independence. Sedition laws were used to charge them and put them in jail. It's a terrible irony that some 70 years after independence, the Indian government is using those same colonial laws to charge students and throw them in jail for chanting slogans, which they say are anti-India slogans. Someone might have raised the pro-Pakistan slogan. Someone might have raised an independent Kashmir slogan. And these sedition laws, along with what turns out now to be doctored videos of, clips from things, which have been broadcast by pliant media channels, have been used to charge these students and throw them in jail. And in court, in the courthouse, when journalists went to cover the event and when this student charged with sedition was brought, people in lawyers' robes, lawyers meant to uphold the laws, came and beat up journalists, beat up the student in full camera view, and then bragged to television stations about how they would do it again. And those people eventually, when charged, have gotten bail almost instantly, while the students still remain in jail.
Sandeep Roy is a journalist based in Kolkata, and we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter at the Huffington Post. Sandeep, let's step back for a minute and just give us a sense of the Conservative Party, because you mentioned Modi a couple of minutes ago. Just to remind listeners, so India's Conservative Opposition Party won elections 2 years ago in a landslide. Tell us about the leader, Narendra Modi, and what has changed since the Conservative Party won.
So Narendra Modi is the leader of the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, which is regarded as a nationalist party in India, more strongly identified with the cause of the Hindutva, or the India as a Hindu nation and he was a sort of a surprise candidate. And when we were mentioning Trump, because Mr. Narendra Modi had been the chief minister of the state of Gujarat, where in 2002 there were enormous Hindu-Muslim riots, really bloody riots. And because he had presided over the state at that time, some people said that he had, if not actively encouraged the riots, but at least not prevented them from happening. And that this was never proven in court. You know, these court cases went on for years. It was never proven that he directly had any involvement with the riots, but was regarded as such a black mark on him. Most people thought when the possibility of Narendra Modi as prime minister came up, that this was impossible in much the same way as people have been saying about Donald Trump right now, like, oh, it's not possible somebody like him could become president. But eventually, the electorate was so frustrated with the ruling Congress party and its sort of years of corruption and corruption scandals, that Mr. Modi, with a sort of strong development platform about showing India good days, won in an enormous landslide across the country. And people thought, as many people do in America at the same time, that even an extreme candidate will moderate and come to the center in power. And Mr. Modi sort of has, as if you've seen, he was at Facebook in the Bay Area, hugging Mark Zuckerberg. You know, he's sort of on bro terms with Barack Obama. He's got a very good figure nationally. But in India, he struck as this strange figure where he, as a man who is most comfortable communicating, has chosen to be silent at very key moments. So right now, while the country is in an uproar about this sedition crisis, Mr. Modi has said almost nothing. A few months ago, when there was a lynching case that had the country in an uproar, where a Hindu mob lynched a Muslim man who was suspected of having beef in his refrigerator, Mr. Modi, for weeks, said nothing. So at key moments, in the meantime, he's tweeting every day about various stuff. So the idea that people are getting from it is that at some level, even if certain over-the-top elements or over-enthusiastic fringe elements in his party are getting carried away with a sort of Hindu nationalist agenda, Mr. Modi is either not controlling them, or at some level, he is okay with it, that his silence is some kind of tacit approval. We don't know, because he's not saying anything much one way or the other. He merely talks about development. But what people are now beginning to think is that that because he is not being able to deliver on his development promises as rapidly as people had wanted him to do, that this nationalism and patriotism is, this surge of nationalism and patriotism is a way to deflect attention from the economic issues and the development problems.
And so how is civil society, and specifically these students, reacting to all of this? I mean, Amnesty International came out with a global report. It was pretty damning in what it said about India, accusing India of cracking down on dissent, accusing India of cracking down on civil society. And now the Conservative Party is calling the students who are taking part in these protests anti-national.
Yes, anti-national and sedition has become quite the buzzword right now. So there is definitely the danger right now is India has gone through a period in the 1970s when the government of Indira Gandhi imposed a state of emergency on the country. But that was regarded as an entirely political act. Mrs. Gandhi's election had been overruled by a court. She felt her power threatened. She declared a state of emergency, saying the country was in crisis. But everyone knew it was a political survival mechanism. Here, what has become dangerous is the government is cloaking all dissent as anti-Indian, anti-national, or anti-Hindu. So religion is being introduced into it. So Mr. Modi's minister is going to parliament and bringing up all kinds of random pamphlets where, you know, some religious god has been derided or referred to in disparaging terms, and it's saying, like, how can we refer to our gods like that? When the issue is that a lawmaker from her own party has been found in court beating up somebody who is a suspect or somebody who is a journalist, they are not addressing that issue. They're bringing up the hypothetical issue of, like, can we stand any insult to a particular god or goddess? So there is a civil society reaction that is happening in terms of students around the country, you know, in different universities, getting upset about the issue. But the government is cracking down quite hard, you know, it's showing no signs of backing off or trying to downplay or calm tempers. And part of it is also because many universities in India, which have student unions, the student unions have often been belong to sort of leftist organizations, even though the Communist parties themselves don't have much role politically anymore. but many of the students' unions are. And the ruling the BJP Conservative Party has its own student union, which is also trying to muscle into this sort of student politics, electoral place. And at the Jawaharlal Nehru University, where this current controversy is happening, a lot of it is actually because of the Conservative Party student union. They are the ones who went to this protest and had a confrontation, and that was videotaped and then broadcast by a television channel. They are the ones who complained to the minister about the slogans. So there is also a turf war of the student politics of the different parties that is happening.
Zach, what are your thoughts on the crackdown on journalism and freedom of speech? As we're seeing a rise of right-wing parties in Europe, and under the Obama administration, there's been a crackdown. But the AP had a piece a couple of months ago called National Security Cited in Crackdown on Journalism Worldwide. And they're citing just a steadily increase in the number of reporters who've been jailed and just a huge increase in the crackdown on journalism around the globe.
Yeah, it seems like a real problem. And the Obama administration's own policies targeting not only journalists, but also whistleblowers within the administration in a lot of different ways, I think, have fed an anti-kind of First Amendment sentiment within within Washington, within the Beltway, in a way that wasn't even really present under President George W. Bush, who was obviously not a fan of the way the Iraq War was covered. So I do think the Obama administration has left themselves open to criticisms from foreign governments that are particularly hostile to journalists, that the administration is being hypocritical when it criticizes other countries for cracking down on a free press.
Zach Carter is senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post, and Sandeep Roy is a journalist based in Kolkata. He used to host this show on Mondays. He's got a novel out. I hope you can check it out, called Don't Let Him Know. It's his debut novel, and you can hear Sandeep's dispatch from Kolkata on Wednesdays at 7:35 a.m. and 4:45 p.m. Sandeep will be with us for a couple more minutes, so if you have any questions about what is happening in India and the crackdown on dissent, the crackdown on civil society and protests, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have a call, Danny in Richmond. Hi, Danny. Welcome to the show.
Hi, actually, it's Denny, like the Grand Slam breakfast.
Ah, hi, Denny.
Frequent caller, longtime listener. Hey, Sandeep,
thanks.
It's great to hear your voice, not just on Wednesdays. But I want you to tell people first what time it is in Calcutta.
Oh, it's way past bedtime. It's about
so people
about
should know how dedicated
midnight.
You are. I work with a lot of civil society organizations on toxics and environmental issues in India. And these folks have been facing, you know, repression from all the different governments, but worse now. Including getting beaten up, you know, just for gathering air samples or peacefully protesting. So, yeah, it's a really big problem that's getting systemic in India. And, of course, Greenpeace had their nonprofit status suspended by the Modi government. Yet, like you say, he's coddled and made into a hero or a brobo by Obama. So I just wanted you to reflect on how widespread this is beyond just the campuses.
Yeah, Danny, thank you for bringing that up. There is, in fact, a sustained issue where one of the comments Mr. Modi has actually made in recent times, not about the student crisis, he has sort of said that there is a conspiracy to destabilize him, and that part of it is led by foreign-funded NGOs or non-governmental organizations. So, yes, it is true, they have gone after Greenpeace. They have gone after the Ford Foundation in India, and a slew of non-governmental organizations have had their licenses rescinded during the Modi administration. Now, I'm going to say some of them may have actually, in fact, had problems with paperwork or financial statements, and I'm not saying that non-governmental organizations should be above audit or above scrutiny, but there definitely does seem to be a very strong tendency in this government to wave the bludgeon stick more firmly at non-governmental organizations that it does not like, the ones that are doing the kind of work Greenpeace does, you know, building civil society, governance rights, working in areas where tribal communities are fighting for land rights or against mining companies and things like that. Those non-profits are facing a much harsher scrutiny under this government.
Well, thank you for calling in with that question, Denny. And Sandeep, before we let you go, I'm very curious, how are the U.S. elections being covered in India?
People are waking up to the U.S. elections right now. You know, now that the momentum is gathering, I think there is immense interest in Donald Trump. You know, people are kind of both mystified and baffled by him as to like how this, because people thought he was sort of the clownish candidate, and now it's time to send in the clowns, and the clown is right there. They feel they're like, how is this possible? And as I was said at the beginning of the program, in certain ways, I think the, you know, Donald Trump is not being foisted from above. He is, you know, he's proving himself through these primaries, and part of it reflects an anger among certain people who are so frustrated with the process that they are willing to condone any excess, even, you know, even a man who says things like, he would want to punch in the face of a protester. And his poll ratings still keep going up within his people who support him. So people are mystified by that, but it is not that difficult to understand when you think about India. When I covered the elections that brought Mr. Modi to power, there was that same sort of anger at the current establishment, and this same almost foolhardy feeling that let's just try this man, even though we know we have grave fears and reservations about him and what he stands for. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and see if he will go and shake the establishment up and kick them in the butt and kick them into shape. And I feel a lot of that same anger and feelings being reposed in a Donald Trump. So who knows? I mean, you know, if Donald Trump, Mr. Modi might get along quite well with Donald Trump.
Zach, people around the globe are mystified, as Sandeep said, about this. How do you explain this to people who are living outside the country?
Well, I guess I would say, first of all, that President Barack Obama, who is a much more decent human being than Donald Trump is, from an objective journalistic standpoint, I think I can say that without harming my reputation, is still very, very close with Prime Minister Modi. So it's not as if the United States is incapable of forging alliances with right-wing ideologues without right-wing ideologues being in power in the United States itself. With regard to Trump's, I think he is certainly surprised Beltway Washingtonian with the level of his popularity. But I think you have to remember that his rise to popularity within the Republican Party has paralleled Bernie Sanders' rise to popularity within the Democratic Party. And prior to Bernie Sanders, we had Elizabeth Warren, who was I think still in many ways actually still more popular than Bernie Sanders as a figure on the American left, certainly within the Democratic Party. All these people are running on and building their political brands on the idea that the economic order that we have seen from Washington, D.C. for the past 30 years has failed working people. And there are a lot of working people who feel that way. I mean, you can look at productivity numbers and see that, you know, the average worker's productivity has gone up consistently over the last 30 years, while wages for everybody outside of the top 10% have actually declined, not only stagnated, but actually declined. So there are a lot of people being left behind by the economic project that started with Ronald Reagan, continued under Bill Clinton, and to a large extent has been continued under Barack Obama. I think Democrats have done a better job marketing this program to working people and to marginalized populations by saying, you know, this will help you in a certain way. But a lot of people, particularly white people in the United States, are find themselves in some way attached to Donald Trump's message that the problem is both Washington elites and for Trump. I mean, I think the really problematic and frightening thing for the United States is not that he's just indicting the last 30 years of economic policy, but he's also going full bore xenophobic and is blaming immigrants. He's blaming Muslims. I mean, he wants to ban basically a fourth of the world's population from coming to the United States. There are some very, very frightening elements of his rhetoric. But we know that in times of economic distress, that people turn to xenophobic solutions. That's not new. It has been going on since World War I. It's been easily documented with statistics since that time period, and I'm sure it was going on for centuries before that. So I don't think that Trump's popularity should surprise students of history. It surprises political pundits whose history goes back to 1980 and haven't seen something like this before.
Mm-hmm. And Sandeep, before we let you go, I know you pay close attention still to the media in the U.S. Have you been surprised at all by the level of coverage given to Donald Trump? I mean, last year, the last 6 months of the year, it was basically all Trump all the time.
I have been surprised and not surprised because, in a sense, Trump was this larger than life figure that that made for great sort of entertainment coverage as opposed to political coverage. What I have been surprised is in the amount of coverage that has been given to Donald Trump, we still know so little about what Donald Trump stands for,
right,
ideologically. So it seems like, given the amount of coverage that we have given to Hillary Clinton and the emails issue and stuff, which have been discussed threadbare and what it means for it, Donald Trump has been covered extensively, but as a curiosity, as a sort of sideshow, as an only in America bizarre circus phenomenon. And now the sideshow has come into the main tent and people are sort of scrambling to figure out what does this man actually stand for. And so in that sense, it is both surprising as to how much Donald Trump has been covered and yet how little we know about who he is.
Yes, and that's what we're going to talk about right after the break with Zach Carter of the Huffington Post. David Sirota will also be joining us with the International Business Times. And Sandeep Roy is a Calcutta-based journalist. You can hear his dispatch from Calcutta on Wednesdays, 7:35 a.m. and 4:45 p.m. Sandeep, thank you for staying up past your bedtime to join us today. It's great to hear you.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255, a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about teaching kids a more accurate, complex lesson about the history of marginalized communities. Every year, hundreds of books in schools and libraries are banned for their alleged cultural and political content. So how should writers engage kids in understanding the past? And what's appropriate for young readers to learn about on their own and in schools? That's on Monday. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news, and we're joined by Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. And now I would like to welcome David Sirota to the show. David is an award-winning journalist and senior editor for investigations at the International Business Times, and he joins us from Denver. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And you've done some really great reporting. And I'll ask you about one of your latest pieces about Walmart contributors to Hillary Clinton's campaign. But first off, what do you make of this Trump phenomenon, David? I mean, we're already getting emails from listeners about Donald Trump. Just about a half hour ago, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie endorsed Donald Trump, saying Marco Rubio looks desperate. Paul just wrote in, every media organization is de facto endorsing Donald Trump by giving him so much airtime while ignoring the over-best candidate, Bernie Sanders. Shame on the media.
Well, I mean, look, I think that you can make that argument if you look at just the amount of coverage there's been of the Democratic and Republican primaries. Is it a bias for Trump, a political bias, or is it a bias for ratings or perceived ratings? Hard to know. I think it's probably on a day-to-day basis, media organizations thinking that Trump will get viewers, get clicks, or what have you, because he's been seen as something of a carnival barker, but he's a serious candidate for president. And I think that that Donald Trump represents two halves, and maybe it's not exactly half, but two sides of a populist revolt and rebellion against the two parties' establishments and against the status quo. Now, I had written a book about this back in 2007 about what I called, the uprising back then, which was that populist revolts, the premise was that populist revolts can express themselves in a conservative way and they can express themselves in a progressive way. And I think that Donald Trump is trying to harness the conservative part of that moment that we're experiencing now, and I think that has made him a serious presidential candidate. And I would also add that I think that his willingness to defy Republican Party orthodoxy makes him a potentially very powerful general election candidate, because I don't believe, based on his record, that he's going to end up campaigning like a hard right conservative ideologue. I mean, he's already in the Republican primary, made some comments and statements about hedge fund managers and tax rates they pay and trade deals and the like that are actually policy statements that are not in line with the Republican Party orthodoxy, but they are in line with a wide swath of the general election electorate and where those folks are. So I think you have to start imagining Donald Trump as a nominee, move it, what will be billed as moving towards the center. And when you see that and you imagine that, you can imagine a very powerful and potentially compelling general election nominee.
Zach, what do we really know about Donald Trump's economic policies and where he stands on these issues? Because other than saying, we're going to build a huge wall and a few other very vague things, kick Muslims out, I mean, we don't know specifics about his plan. I mean, I've been watching all these Republican debates, and the moderators have done a pretty bad job of saying, where do you actually stand on these issues? It's kind of shocking. After so many debates, we just don't have specifics.
It's very difficult to know where Donald Trump stands on anything, because he's a serial liar and will just say something one day and 2 days later deny that he had ever said it. But he does have a tax plan that he's put forward, and the very conservative Tax Foundation think tank, which is funded by the Koch brothers, has, I think, extremely conservative, Republican-friendly analyses of how taxes work. Even their analysis says that Donald Trump's tax plan would cost the country somewhere between $10 and $12 trillion. And to put that in perspective, and when we talk about numbers this big, I think it's very easy to sort of get zero whiplash, where there's just zeros and zeros going on everywhere. That's about three-fourths of the existing national debt. So even under estimates that Republicans like, his tax plan would cost the country about 75% of the existing national debt. So he's not unique among Republicans in putting forward sort of fantastical tax plans where he promises to cut tax rates for rich people by enormous amounts and then says that there is going to be some sort of massive rebirth of economic growth as a result of this this policy platform. Most of the other candidates do something like this. But that's basically his tax platform. But we do know that he talks about trade in a very forceful and vocal way. And the way that he talks about trade and his trade platform is not that different from what Bernie Sanders and what American labor unions have been talking about for the last 30 years. He basically says that the United States is running an unsustainable trade deficit, and that that leaders in Washington have been negotiating deals that rip off American workers. And it's hard to argue with history on that. I mean, he has a point. He is running an openly racist and xenophobic campaign, but in this sort of populist sense, he's appealing to longstanding, I think, and valid, in this case at least, feelings of American workers that they have been left behind by the economic establishment in Washington.
But the question is, what is he going to do about it? I mean, he has called Obama's TPP plan insane. On the day of the Nevada primaries, Donald Trump's employees actually picketed his Nevada hotel. That didn't really get that much attention. Mother Jones reported on this. Hotel employees were saying no contract, no peace, as they chanted outside of his hotels. So, like, where does he stand on unions, for example? Where does he stand on minimum wage?
Well, I mean, he's been all over the place on these issues. You know, last night at the Republican debate, there were several Republicans, I believe Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, both beat him up for this, pointing out that there were people who had sued him in the construction of Trump Tower for straightforward wage theft. That's not a good type of record that you want to have if you're trying to appeal to working people. And we've seen in other debates, he said, you know, I think American wages are too high. We have to lower our wages to stay competitive. That's just reality. 2 days later, he said he never said that. He is all over the place on his economic policy platform. He's doing everything he can to appeal to working class white people in the United States, but he's also still part of the sort of New York billionaire class. And I don't think it's necessarily a natural fit for him to appeal to working class white people. He's just trying harder than either the Republican candidates or Hillary Clinton, the establishment Democratic favorite.
Yeah, David, where is the scrutiny of Donald Trump's economic plan and his past? The Daily Beast has a piece called "Trump Tower Was Built on Undocumented Polish Immigrants' Backs." According to testimony in a protracted civil suit in federal court, the laborers were paid $5 an hour or less when they were paid at all. Some went unpaid after the contractor had financial troubles. I mean, we're seeing so many reports out there about Bernie Sanders' plan to provide free tuition at public colleges or health care for all, for example. Where's the same scrutiny for Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's been lacking. I think it's been scattershot. But I think that that vacuum, if you will, has been in part because of the presumption that Donald Trump is not running on his record. Donald Trump is running as a kind of, if not a cult of personality, then he's running on him as a person. And I think the perception is that accountability journalism with somebody who's not really in any way at all running on his record or his proposals is disincentivized by the perception that kind of journalism won't have any impact. And I think, I mean, look, there have been some big stories about Donald Trump. There was a big Washington Post piece about his going through bankruptcy and the like, and it really didn't make much of an impact. Now, there's many reasons for that. But I think that what's going on here is that Trump has constructed a campaign that really isn't about anything that he's actually done in the past. It is really a campaign that's based on the notion that he can simply get things done. And in a sense, which is also pretty amazing, is that when the reports have come out about him, his business practices and some of the ethical issues, it in a sense feeds into the argument that he's making that effectively he's willing to step on and step over and crush opposition to what he wants to get done. So there's a very authoritarian theme running through Donald Trump and the support for him. This idea that we'll just ram things through and get them done no matter what it means, no matter what it affects, no matter necessarily what rules or laws it may ignore.
What are your thoughts about how the reaction from the establishment Republicans are responding to Trump? Senator Lindsey Graham, very conservative Republican from South Carolina, was speaking at the Washington Press Club, and he said that his party has gone batshit crazy. And then in the Washington Post, Robert Kagan, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, who is a Republican, has a piece out called "Trump is the GOP's Frankenstein Monster, and now he's strong enough to destroy the party." He says, "What to do now? The Republicans' creation will soon be let loose on the land, leaving to others the job the party failed to carry out." He's now a former Republican. As he says, for this former Republican and perhaps for others, the only choice will be to vote for Hillary Clinton. The party cannot be saved, but the country still can be. Zach, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Robert Kagan is a particularly interesting person in this whole dialogue, because if you watched not the most recent Republican debate, but the one prior, in which Donald Trump just dumped all over President George W. Bush's foreign policy legacy, it became very clear that Trump was running, that his sort of populist campaign, his right-wing populist campaign, was not afraid of taking on the essentially conservative foreign policy orthodoxy. And Robert Kagan is a very committed foreign policy hawk. He's a neoconservative. He believes that, you know, the United States should be using its power, its military power abroad, to bring freedom and good things to other countries and liberate them from oppressive regimes. That is, a standard view, not only in the Republican Party, but also within establishment Democratic Party politics. There aren't a whole lot of areas in which Robert Kagan, for instance, and Hillary Clinton disagree. But Donald Trump has said that he now at least is opposed to the Iraq War. He thinks that foreign military adventurism by the United States is a bad idea. So it makes sense from a strictly policy oriented perspective that someone like Robert Kagan would no longer be able to support a Republican nominee if that Republican nominee abandoned the sort of core philosophical belief behind Robert Kagan's life, which is that very aggressive and assertive American use of force, of military force abroad, will make the world a better place. That's very clearly not what Donald Trump is running on. And I think this is one of the areas in which I think Democrats sort of underestimate his appeal. There's a sense in which, particularly if you watch that debate, the things that Donald Trump said about George W. Bush are things that Democrats have, I think, long believed, but have been terrified of saying in public for fear that they would be criticized as being unpatriotic, un-American, disrespectful to a president during wartime. He basically said that George W. Bush dropped the ball on September 11th, and that those attacks happened because George W. Bush was incompetent. That's something that you would expect to hear from Michael Moore. It's not something that you're ever going to hear Hillary Clinton say. And I think there is a very real electoral heft to that among both Republicans and Democrats who do not live in Washington, D.C., and who do not attend conferences at think tanks in Washington, D.C. So I do not think it's surprising that Robert Kagan is more in favor of Hillary Clinton, who is a more conventional sort of neoconservative hawk on most foreign policy issues. But I also think Democrats are really underestimating the electoral power of that message.
Yeah, he also came out and said George W. lied about WMD in Iraq. And, Bernie's basically going after Hillary for voting for the U.S. to invade Iraq, but not really spending much time saying that George W. lied about it.
Yeah, I think Bernie Sanders is generally uncomfortable talking about foreign policy, and he's so far, at least within the Democratic primary, been sort of bailed out by the fact that most Democrats had their foreign policy beliefs sort of shaped by the Iraq War. I mean, most contemporary Democrats are anti-war and anti-American military adventurism. And yet Hillary Clinton's policy platform, even though she clearly knows a lot more about foreign policy than Bernie Sanders does, it's just a policy platform that most Democrats don't really like. And so Sanders, anytime these things come up, he just sort of tries to pivot away and start talking about economic policy again, because he's much more well-versed in those issues. But you're right. I mean, he doesn't attack George W. Bush on these issues. He just says that he didn't vote for Iraq, for the war in Iraq, but Hillary Clinton did, and that was a mistake on Hillary Clinton's part, and he was right. And let's get back to talking about economic inequality.
Zach Carter is senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post, and David Sirota is senior editor for investigations at the International Business Times. And David, you've got a piece out called "Despite Walmart Ties: Support for Free Trade, Hillary Clinton Touts Commitment to Manufacturing Jobs." And you took a look at the people who have donated to the Hillary Victory Fund, and you found that Walmart heir Alice Walton donated $353,000. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Hillary Clinton has set up one of these joint fundraising committees that are supposed to be sharing its money with state parties. And they found a very innovative way to basically raise the total amount that can be given to a joint fundraising committee. Alice Walton, as you mentioned, is one of the big donors to Hillary Clinton's, the Hillary Victory Fund. Hillary Clinton has long ties to Walmart. She was a board member there when the company was beginning its now notorious shift of its supply chain over to China, which ended up reducing manufacturing employment in the United States because Walmart's so big, by hundreds of thousands of jobs. A Walmart lobbyist recently held a fundraiser for her campaign in Mexico City. So her ties to Walmart are extensive. Her votes for major free trade support for, I should say, for major free trade agreements like NAFTA, like the China PNPR deal, like the South Korea Free Trade Agreement, the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. That support is well known, and those deals have been criticized by unions, consumer groups, and the like for eliminating millions of manufacturing jobs. So what's interesting is that heading into the Rust Belt primaries that are on the horizon now, Clinton is preemptively pushing out the idea that she's always had a, and this is her campaign's words, a, quote, lifelong commitment to protecting manufacturing jobs. And it's worth looking at whether that's true in the sense of her work history, her board history at Walmart, and her support for trade agreements. And as in that story, we noted that in particular, there's been this question about whether what she says in public is what she does, what kind of policy proposals she'll push in private. And there were emails that just came out last week that showed that on the Colombia and South Korea free trade agreement, which she had publicly promised voters she would oppose in 2008, in those emails that came out from the State Department, it showed her actually lobbying Democratic U.S. senators to support those trade agreements while she was Secretary of State. So this raises a whole set of questions about, especially on trade, she's been on many sides of the issues of, is whether her argument that she's for manufacturing jobs will be able to counter the scrutiny that she may get of her record on those issues.
David, there's been some really good reporting the last couple of weeks about Hillary Clinton's record. Salon has a great piece about welfare reform and her support for it when Bill Clinton was president. And then Michelle Alexander wrote a piece in The Nation about the, you know, quote unquote, tough on crime legislation that was passed under Bill Clinton, which resulted in mass incarceration today. What are your thoughts about this reporting? I mean, I have to wonder if it would be done if it weren't for Bernie Sanders running. But you also hear a lot of people say, yeah, we get that happened and that's good reporting, but we have to support Hillary because Bernie's not electable.
Well, I mean, Hillary Clinton's record, because she's running in a primary, is now and against a very progressive candidate, is now being scrutinized in a way that it wasn't, I don't think. It wasn't scrutinized in 2008 when she was running against a candidate who appeared to have views that were much closer to her own. I mean, I think there are very distinct differences between her and Sanders, and so this reporting, I think, is reflecting those differences. What's I think interesting right now is that it's not clear that reporting is having all that much of an impact. I mean, I think you can make an argument either way. I mean, I think you can say, look, this senator from Vermont who did not have much of a national profile, presidential profile, in the fact that it's even a competitive race, proves that these concerns have been out there. But I also think that the fact that there are these really, really very deeply important sets of issues and stories about Clinton to distinct parts of the Democratic electorate, like people of color and the like, and how though that reporting, her record on criminal justice, her record on welfare reform has not necessarily proven yet, if at all, to be a major factor in the election. I mean, you could say that's a testament to the fact that she's presented a campaign that's changed the message from that and addressed it preemptively. But you can also say that in part it's hard to make stories land and make stories have impact in a media environment where there's just simply so much noise.
Well, also, Zach, what's interesting is those really good in-depth analysis pieces tend to come out in the alternative media, like Salon and The Nation, whereas I'm noticing that a lot of the scrutiny of Bernie Sanders, for example, about his tuition-free plan, health care for all, comes out in The New York Times and The Washington Post. Is that an accurate assessment? What are your thoughts?
Well, I haven't read all of the coverage from every single publication, but I would point out that there has been a rather noticeable bend among elite economists in the Democratic Party to assail Bernie Sanders' plans in ways that I think are pretty, at least in some cases, pretty obviously unfair and a little bit cheap. And these are big names. I mean, these are people including Paul Krugman, who I think a lot of Democrats who are not economic experts trust to provide them with, you know, unvarnished, clear-cut analyses of different proposals from different campaigns, and it's abundantly clear. I mean, in the last week or so, you know, the Sanders campaign just came under withering fire from several former Obama administration and Clinton administration officials, and also from Paul Krugman, because of one analysis that a guy from an economist named Gerald Friedman from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst had done. The Friedman analysis was totally conventional, and it found that, surprise, when you have a very ambitious economic platform, if you use conventional economic models, you get very, very eye-popping results, like economic growth rates of like 5.3%, which is a lot. Hmm. I mean, right now we're doing about 2.4%. But instead of having, you know, the sort of conventional economic establishment voices say, well, look, that's what you would expect given conventional analyses of this type of ambitious program. They just said, well, these results are obviously ridiculous, and this is a total hack job. And this person should not be taken seriously, and neither should Bernie Sanders.
Well,
and that ended up in the New York Times.
And the interesting thing is Gerald Friedman, the economist that is praising Bernie Sanders' economic policy, is voting for Hillary Clinton.
A political supporter of Hillary Clinton, yes.
Yes.
And yet he's been accused of operating in bad faith to rig the system in favor of Bernie Sanders.
Right. Well, we're going to do a show about this because it's so important in a couple of weeks. Zach Carter is senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. David Sirota is senior editor for investigations at the International Business Times. Zach and David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.